as he swam past, just as good of a swimmer as Brady. A log was jutting out from the bank and I grabbed onto it, watching. The current was so fast it was pulling my legs downriver as my body clung to the wood. And then I saw Brady. He was floating, face down. He wasn't swimming. I screamed again, pointing toward him as I watched his body slam into a rock, and then another. James's arms were furiously lapping over and over, but Brady was too far ahead. I started to cry, sobs curling my body around the branch. When Brady's body slammed against another rock, it stayed there long enough for James to reach him. James banged against the boulder, crying out as he did, but he pulled Brady to shore and started giving him CPR. He was frantic, pounding on his chest, breathing into his lungs. But I could see from where I was that even if Brady wasn't full of water, his neck was broken. His head hung oddly to the side. His eyes stared out at nothing. My brother, my best friend, was dead. Comforting numbness seemed to stretch over me then. James was crying, screaming for help. He stood up, his hand shielding the sun as he looked for me. And I let go of the branch, letting the icy water pull me under. I'd tried to drown, and really, it wouldn't have been that hard. The current was strong enough to keep me under, and I hoped I would pass out, blocking the images of my dead brother's last stare. I knew I couldn't go on. I couldn't face my parents, my life. But then James had his forearm around my neck, pulling me to the bank to lay me on my back. I was choking, vomiting even then. My ears were plugged, but I could see James above me, tapping my cheeks to keep me awake. When I could keep my eyes open, he left, running to his towel where his phone was. James saved me. But he couldn't save Brady. Neither of us could. In the end, we did just as my brother asked. We took care of one another. Sometimes the survivor's guilt was more than we could bear, a secret between us that we never let show. But we were all we had left. As I sit in James's house Monday morning, watching as he slowly pushes his bandaged arm through a shirt I picked out, I think that it's always been him doing the work. James has been the constant. Now that part of him is broken, finally infected. And just like that day at the river, I want to let go and go under. "I brought Pop-Tarts," I say, brushing his hair aside as he sits and stares out the window. "When's the funeral?" he asks, his voice so low I can barely hear it. I swallow hard. After I left James Saturday night, I pushed down every feeling I had, let myself become a machine, doing whatever's necessary to keep us alive, together. When I got home, my parents told me that Miller's mom had called and spoken with them. "They're not having a funeral," I say. "The program thinks it might instigate more suicide, so just his mom is allowed to bury him." Miller's face, his smile, pops into my head, but I quickly lock it away. There is no time to mourn. James presses his lips tight together as his eyes well up. "It was my fault," he says. "Just like Brady. I was too late. I should have never left him behind." I wrap my arms around James. "Miller was sick, James. There was nothing we could do." He turns in my arms. "And Brady? I was there and I couldn't save him." My heart aches, but I can't let myself think about Brady today, not when we have to go to school. "I couldn't either, and what's done is done. You need to pull yourself together." James reaches up to put his palm on my cheek, and I turn my face into it. "I can't," he murmurs. I stare into his blue eyes, panicking, but I press my forehead against his. "I will save you this time," I whisper. "I will save us both." James pulls me into a hug, burying his face in my neck, and I run my fingers down his back, trying to calm him. I've never felt strong, not when so many things in this world are out of my control. But now I have to be, because I'm all we have. Chapter 9. In the past day, have you felt lonely or overwhelmed? No. Have there been any changes in your sleeping patterns? No. I haven't slept since Miller died. Has anyone close to you ever committed suicide? I fill in no. I stare at the darkened oval, willing it to be true. Wishing that I could ever just fill in the goddamn no. I blink back the tears that are starting, and I erase the mark, making sure no traces of it exist. And then, with coldness in my soul, I fill in yes. After an hour of intensive therapy to deal with my loss, I find James at my locker and walk him to his classroom, making sure he can pass for normal, at least for 50 minutes. When I get to economics, the first person I see is the handler, the dark-haired one who's always watching me. Next to mine, Miller's desk is empty, and a deep hollow feeling opens in my chest. But in the corner, watching me with a soft smile on his lips, as if he's been waiting for me, is the handler. My heart races as I sit, not looking back at him again. I wonder if I'm about to get flagged. Please, God, don't let them take me. When the bell rings, Mr. Rocco walks in and shoots an uneasy glance at Miller's desk, and then at the handler before launching into his lesson. I clasp my hands under my desk, squeezing tightly to keep my composure. It's torture, trying to pay attention, trying to put up the appearance of wellness. I want my phone to vibrate so that I know James is okay too, but nothing happens. Sweat has started to gather on my upper lip, and I feel like I can't take another moment of not knowing how James is when the bell finally rings. I jump and immediately stuff my book into my backpack, standing quickly as I head toward the door. Just then, someone grabs my arm. I swing around, startled, and am face to face with the handler. I suck in a breath, nearly falling over. It's happening. No, 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 it's happening. The handler lets go of my elbow and smiles sympathetically. Sloane Barstow, he says, and his gravelly voice is like sandpaper on my soul. I'm sorry for your loss. I just have a few questions for you, if you don't mind. His eyes are wide and dark, his skin a deep olive. He's 20, maybe younger, but I see no true compassion on his face. I see something else. Something that makes my stomach knot. He wants to take me. I already had therapy today, I say, stepping back from him. He laughs. This isn't therapy. Follow me, please. He walks past me, and I'm struck again by the medicinal smell of the handler's. I wonder if he has drugs on him right now that could put me out, something they occasionally do when apprehending someone for the program. Or he could use the taser at his waist. I feel for my phone in my pocket, but don't dare text James. I need him to stay calm. But then I wonder if they've gotten to him, too. I hope not. He's in no condition for an interview. It happens after a suicide. They send us all to counselors to make sure we're okay. Sometimes a few extras are sent in to interview those who aren't taking the loss well. But it's rarely a handler. It makes me uneasy that this is the same guy who's been watching me since taking Kendra. But I have no choice, so I follow him toward the main office. When we get there, a small room is ready for us. Two chairs face each other in the dim space. I gulp down my fear as I enter, hating the idea of being alone with this guy. But principals and teachers don't interfere with the program. They look the other way when I enter. Please sit, the handler says, closing the door behind us and drawing the blinds. My fear is so strong, but I know I can't let it show. I take a deep breath and lower myself into the chair. This really isn't necessary, I say, trying to sound like a normal girl. I hardly knew Miller. The handler smiles at this, coming to sit across from me, the knees of his white pants almost touching mine. I try not to flinch away from him. Really? He asks, obviously knowing the answer. Well, then how about Lacey Klamath? Or perhaps your brother? Were you close with them? I must visibly pale when he mentions Brady, because he bows his head as if apologizing. Miss Barstow, it has come to our attention that you are high risk. You've suffered tremendous loss recently, so it's only my intention to evaluate you. He's lying. He wants to flag me. They don't care about us, only the appearance that what they do works. I curl my toes hard in my shoes as the handler runs his eyes slowly over me. Goosebumps rise on my skin. Let's start with Miller. You were out of town when he terminated himself, correct? I hate him for making it sound clinical. Yes. And Lacey was your best friend, but you were not aware of her condition before she was sent to the program? You weren't trying to hide it from us?
No, I had no idea.
And then I can sense what's coming. Are you hiding anything now?
No.
I keep my face as calm as possible, meeting his eyes. I imagine that I'm a robot, void of feelings, void of life. Do you have a boyfriend, Sloane? The corner of his mouth curves up when he asks, as if he's some guy I just met who's trying to flirt.
Yes,
James Murphy.
Oh, God.
Mm-hmm. And how is he doing?
James is fine. He's strong.
Are you strong? He asks, tilting his head as he looks at me.
Yes.
The handler nods then. It's only our hope to keep you well, Sloane. You know that, right? I don't respond, wondering what James will say under these questions, if they'll know from one look that he's sick. There is voluntary admittance into the program if you start to feel overwhelmed, or if you just need someone to talk to. He reaches out then and pats my thigh, a move that catches me off guard, and I jump. The handler stands up and walks around my chair as if he's leaving. Instead, he stops behind me, putting his hand on my shoulder. His fingers tighten on the muscle. Have a good day, Sloane. Something tells me I'll be seeing you again soon. And then he drops his arm and walks out, leaving me alone in the darkened room. I practically run to lunch, terrified that James won't be there. I stop, swaying on my feet when I see him at our table, drinking from a carton of orange juice. You're okay, I say, when I reach him, practically collapsing onto his lap as I hug myself to him. He doesn't hug me back, but he doesn't push me off either. I press my face to his neck. Yeah, he says quietly. I'm okay. I pull back and look at his face, trying to gauge how damaged he is. His skin is pale and his mouth is sagging, like he's forgotten how to smile. I run my fingers over his cheek, and he closes his eyes when I do. I was so worried, I whisper. He doesn't move, and I hug him again, holding him tight like I want him to do for me. But he doesn't. After a while, I let him go, and he starts to eat, taking small bites of his food. He stares across the cafeteria, but at no particular point. Just away.
Has anyone interviewed you? I ask.
He shakes his head no.
They pulled me from class, I say.
James looks over at me. What happened?
They asked about Miller. About you.
He doesn't react. Instead, he just turns back to his food. I miss him so much, even though he's right in front of me. He's not the same.
No one's spoken to me, he says. I haven't even seen any handlers today. And although that should make me feel better, his statement only makes me more uneasy. Why did they pull me? Either I was the one being evaluated, or they were collecting evidence on James. I'm not sure which it was. I want to get out of town, I say. Do you think you can get away? I want to go camping again. James chews slowly. I can try. The emptiness in his voice is killing me, and I'm not sure I can keep this up much longer. Don't you want to go with me? I ask, my voice small. He nods. Of course I do, baby. I exhale, leaning to put my head on James's shoulder. Under the table, his hand finds mine, and I feel better, like this small show of life can mean something. Movement in the corner catches my attention, and I dart my eyes over there, finding the handler watching me with a smile on his lips. Chapter 10. The rest of the week is more of the same. I try to keep up the appearance of normal, especially when I feel him watching us. The handler is in my classes, the cafeteria, always staring, always a smirk on his face. It's like he's willing me to mess up. They don't pull James aside for an interview, and I wonder what it means. Did I seem more depressed to the handler? Have they already decided to take James? When Friday comes, I practically drag James from the building, so relieved that I won't have to fake it through another day. But oddly enough, I don't think I want to cry either. I've almost convinced myself that Miller really wasn't our best friend. It's the only way I can deal. I prepack the car so we can head directly to the campsite. James is silent in the passenger seat, staring out the window. My parents seemed a little wary about us going so soon after Miller, maybe even a little suspicious. They asked why James hasn't been by the house, and I told them he was studying, which is probably why they were suspicious in the first place. At James's house, I've been a permanent fixture, whispering to him and pretending like we're being playful when his dad is around. Really, I'm just telling him to hang on. I put him in his bed at night and tell him that I love him and that I won't let anything happen to him. He doesn't say it back. I'm scared that he never will again. James sits, staring at the fire pit while I put up the tent, grunting and scraping myself with the poles. I continue to look over at him, but he never looks back. When the camp is set up, I grab my sleeping bag from the car, feeling exhausted. I call to him, tossing the other bag in his direction. You can at least bring in your own sleeping bag, I say, trying to sound light. You're making me do everything. He doesn't respond, but he does get up, walking behind me to the tent. He climbs inside as we lay out our bags, his gaze a million miles away. Hey, I say, pausing in front of him to brush back his hair. Do you want to lie down for a little bit? His eyes meet mine, but only for a second, and then he nods and kneels down on his bag, spreading out on his back. I chew on my lip as I get down next to him, curling up against him the way he used to like. My thigh over his, my face at the crook of his neck. I rest my hand on his chest and listen to him breathe. He doesn't touch me. I miss you, I say quietly. I'm so lonely without you, James. I'm trying to be strong, but I'm not sure how much I have left. You have to come back to me. I don't think I can get through this alone. My eyes well up, but James doesn't move. God, I just want him back. I want to hear his laugh, his sarcastic comments, his fake ego. I love you, I whisper, and the tent is quiet. I'm losing him, just like I lost the others. I sniffle back the start of tears and talk like he's there with me. I won't let you go, you know, I say. I'm never going to just give up, so don't even think about getting another girlfriend. I smile, pretending he laughed. I know things are bad right now, but they'll get better. You're not like Brady. You won't quit. You won't leave me on the side of a river wondering why. You're stronger than that. I know you are. I slide my hand under his shirt, resting it over his heart. His skin is warm, familiar. The beating is slow. We should probably get that heart rate up, I say lightly. You could use the exercise. I get up on my elbow, looking down into his beautiful face, his eyes fixed on a point beyond the tent that I can't see. Hey, I whisper. When he slowly drags his gaze to mine, it's lost and unfocused. James and I have a million shared memories, but somehow I know that talking about his Little League games or the time he sliced open his foot on a rock isn't going to snap him out of this. Instead, I run my hand down his upper body and over his stomach, stopping when I get to the top of his jeans. And when I slip my hand inside them, his eyelids flutter and he takes a breath, but just a small one. I think quickly, remembering that I don't have any condoms. I doubt James brought any, and neither of us, right mind or not, would ever take a chance, not in this world. But I want him. I want him to forget how sad he is. I love you, I say, but James's eyes are shut. I lean down and kiss softly at his lips, nearly stopping when he doesn't respond. Then I kiss his neck, his chest. I undo his button as I kiss his stomach, and then lower. And it isn't until I feel his hand in my hair and hear him murmur my name breathlessly that I know I have him back, even if only for a second. Do you want me to build a fire? I ask. James is wrapped tightly around me, his cheek against the back of my neck. No, he says softly, holding me. I just want to stay here with you. I smile a little and realize it's the first real smile I've had since Miller died. The thought of him makes the happiness quickly fade. Miller would want you to be okay, I whisper. James swallows hard and his arms loosen from around me. I'm not well, Sloane, James says. I turn and face him. His eyes are bloodshot, his chin growing stubbly. Don't say that, I tell him. I'm going to kill myself. My entire chest seizes up and I grab James hard, pulling him toward me. Don't you dare, I cry out. I swear to God, James. But I'm shaking so hard I'm not even sure he can understand my words. Don't leave me, I sob. Please don't leave me here alone. Please. Slowly, James puts his arms around me and guides me against his chest, brushing back my hair. Sloane, he says, I can't go into the program. I don't want to forget you. Forget Brady. I pull back and look at him. Do you think you'll remember if you're dead? You promised me, James. You promised forever. Tears roll down my cheeks, and I expect him to wipe them and tell me it's going to be okay. Instead, he tightens his arms, clinging to me silently as I rest beside him. But he didn't agree to not kill himself. Please hold on, I whisper. Tell me you'll hold on. His breath is warm against my skin. I'll try. We lie around in the tent until it's dark, leaving only to get energy bars and water, and then later to use the bathroom. I don't sleep all night, worried about what tomorrow will bring, wondering if the old James will ever come back. And when the sun rises again, I look over at him hopefully. He's on his back, staring into nothing, and I know that he's lost. And so am I. Chapter 11. It's been 2 weeks and 2 days since Miller died, but James is still not himself. I'm exhausted keeping up our front, pretending to be okay. I do James's homework, ripping out his pages of black spirals and instead writing in math logarithms. I walk him to his classes, making sure he doesn't try to buy quick death, always watching if anyone notices his change. It's clear they do. Other students avert their eyes when we pass, not wanting to be associated with us for the risk of getting flagged. I know time is running out, and so I overcompensate even more. I get louder with my laughter, kiss James passionately in the hallway, even though he doesn't respond. I'm starting to forget what he was like before. I'm starting to forget what we were like before. Nearly a month after Miller's death, our classes change for the semester. James ends up in my math class by some miracle, or maybe it's the fact that our student population continues to dwindle. There have been 2 suicides since Miller. I notice an increase in handlers, including the one who watches me. And he's here now, standing at the door of our class with another handler, staring in. Next to me, James sits, looking down at his desk. He hasn't taken out his notebook. He doesn't move. "James," I whisper, hoping not to draw attention to us. "Please." But he doesn't respond. There is a shuffling of feet, and I know it before I even look up, know it by the sound of gasps in the room. My eyes start to water, but I hold back the tears and watch my boyfriend. I know what's coming next. "I love you," I murmur to James. "You'll come back to me." My words are barely a breath when the white coats come into my vision, surrounding him, grabbing him from his chair. I almost vomit, but I grip my desktop and keep back my tears. Around me, the other students drop their heads, not wanting to betray their emotions. My James. My James. The handlers are pulling him to the door, but James suddenly looks back at me, his blue eyes wide. He starts to fight, tearing from their grip. My face nearly breaks with a cry. "Sloan," he yells, falling to his knees as they hold him. "Wait," he says fiercely to them. But they're not listening. They're pulling him back, the one handler shooting me a glare, warning me to not respond. I try to smile, anything to let James know that he'll survive this, and that I'll be here when he gets back. I kiss my fingers and hold them up in a wave. He stops, letting the handlers get a hold of him. Then James closes his eyes and lets them drag him to his feet and out the door. When he's gone, several people look back at me. The teacher stares at me. Everyone is waiting to see my reaction, if I'll be next, if they'll come rushing in here any second. But I do nothing. Inside, I'm dying, ripping apart and bleeding. I'm so far gone, I'm not sure I can get back. But I open my notebook and poise my pencil over it, as if ready to write. I keep my breaths measured, waiting. And then the teacher starts talking again, going on about the latest math concept. I hear the chairs squeak as the other students give her their attention. I don't wipe my face as one tear, one I just couldn't hold back, hits my notebook with a quiet tap. I close my eyes. James has always been terrible at math. Brady used to try to teach him, but it was no use. My boyfriend was completely helpless. I remember once while they were doing homework, Brady called me into the kitchen. He and James were at the table, books spread out in front of them. It had been a month since that first camping trip when James caught me staring. I'd spent every moment since then avoiding him. I tried to pretend that nothing had changed, even though I'd see him looking at me strangely, as if trying to figure out if he should talk to me or not. He did still talk, but I never met his eyes. I already felt stupid enough. "Sloan," Brady called, "check this out." I walked into the kitchen, taking an uneasy glance at James as he sipped his soda, not acknowledging me. "What's up?" I asked my brother, nervousness in the pit of my stomach. Brady pointed his finger to a problem on the page, a math formula with an example. "What's the answer?" Brady asked, grinning widely and looking over at James, who was continuing to not notice me. I swallowed hard and then narrowed my eyes, computing the problem in my head. "X equals 8," I said. "Why?" Brady laughed and James shook his head, a smile on his lips. James reached in his pocket and pulled out a $5 bill, slapping it on my brother's open book. Brady picked up the money triumphantly. "Told you she was smarter than you." "I never said she wasn't," James answered, finally darting a glance at me. "I already know your sister is smarter. She's prettier than me, too, but I didn't bet on that. I just wanted you to call her in here so she'd look at me again. It was worth the $5. Before I could even understand what he'd said, James was flipping through his book, the corner of his mouth turned up in a half-grin. Brady handed me the $5. "You deserve this," he said, "for always putting up with his shit." Brady laughed it away as if James was just teasing me, and my face burned with embarrassment. Humiliation. I crumpled up the money and tossed it at James, bouncing it off his cheek. He looked up, surprised, and Brady chuckled. "I don't want your money," I said, and turned to go up the stairs toward my room. "Then what do you want, Sloane?" James called after me, sounding amused, as if daring me to answer. I paused at the stairs, but didn't turn around. And then I went to my room. I know James won't come looking for me this time. Not like he did that day, apologizing. James is in the program now. The James I know is gone.
"Sloane, honey,"
I hear my mother say on the other side of my bedroom door. I lay listlessly on my bed, willing myself to answer her.
"Yeah? It's time for dinner. Can you please come down? I've called 3 times already."
Had she?
"Sure, okay."
I slowly stand, looking down at my clothes. I wish that there were bloodstains or tears, something to outwardly show how hurt I am. But instead, it's just a pair of jeans and a pink t-shirt, something so painfully average that it makes me hate myself. I head downstairs. My parents sit at the dining room table, pleasant smiles plastered across their faces. I try to return a smile of my own, but I'm not sure I pull it off. My father's brow creases.
"I made your favorite," my mother says. "Spaghetti and meatballs."
I know the homemade sauce took her forever to make, so I say thank you. I take a seat and wonder what sort of pills I can find in the medicine cabinet, wondering if I can find something to help me sleep. "James's father called," my mother says softly. "He told us James was sent to the program today." My stomach twists around her words, and I reach out to sip from my water. The ice cubes rattle in the glass as my hand shakes.
"He's going to be safe now," my mother adds. "We're all so grateful for the program. We hadn't even known he was ill."
I'd known. But now I also know that he's gone, and when he comes back, I won't be a part of his life. He'll be wiped clean. "Sloane," my father says in a low tone, "your mother is talking to you." I look up at him, the anger clearly on my face because he straightens in his chair. "What would you like me to say to that?" I ask, my voice barely controlled. "What is the appropriate response?" "That you're happy that he's going to get better. That you're happy he won't harm himself."
"They took him," I snap. "They came into class and they dragged him out. There's nothing happy about this."
"Sloane," my mother says, sounding startled, "did you know he was sick?
You didn't try to conceal it, did you? He could have...
She stops, looking horrified. I can't believe they don't understand. I wonder if it's because adults would rather forget about their problems, the thought that ignorance is bliss. But the program steals our memories. They reset our emotions so that we're brand new, never having been hurt or heartbroken. But who are we without our pasts?
James would have rather died than gone to the program, I say, picking up my fork. And now I know why.
My mother tosses her napkin onto the table.
He's going to get help, Sloane. Isn't that what matters? I wish we would have gotten to Brady in time.
I cry out, the rage inside me too much to contain.
Are you really that stupid? I shout at her. Do you really think Brady would have wanted his memory erased? Nobody wants this, Mom. No one wants to be numb. They're killing us.
No, she yells back.
You're killing yourselves. They're saving you. By taking away everything that made my life worth living? Is this just about James? Honey, I'm sure when he comes back...
I throw my fork across the room, banging it off the wall.
It's not just James. They'll take out parts of me, parts of Brady. I won't even know my friends. I won't remember why I love going to the river. It's because that's where James first kissed me. Did you know that? That's where he first told me he loved me. And now they'll take that from him and he won't remember. He won't even know who he is. If it's meant to be, you'll find each other again.
I scoff.
I hate you,
I say, tears streaming from my eyes. I told my mother that once before, after my brother died. She threatened to send me to the program, and I never said it again. Now I stare at her, all my emotions spinning into a dark spiral.
Actually, I take it back, I say to her, smiling sadly. I hate myself more.
And then I run for my mother's car in the garage, needing to get away from her and from everything. Chapter 12. I drive through the country, the long route that James and I used to take. I don't turn on the radio. I don't turn down the blasting heater. Instead, I let sweat race down my back. It's suffocating and thick in here, but I don't care. I slow down when I get to the stretch of farm where there is nothing but cows, them and me. When I'm on the side of the road, I put the car in park and stare down at my hand, at the purple ring that James gave me. It doesn't take long for me to dissolve into tears, screaming until my voice breaks completely. I'm practically hyperventilating when the thought hits me, when the clarity of it is too much to resist. It's like a sudden calm, erasing my pain. It's peacefulness. I wipe absently at my face and sit up straighter, shifting the car into gear. I know what to do. What James would have done if I'd let him. There's no way I can hide my despair. They'll come for me soon enough, if they're not planning to already. They'll take me away, mess with my mind, clear away my memories of James, Miller, and possibly even Brady. They'll take away everything that makes me, me, and send me back clean, empty. I almost smile as I swing onto the road, driving too fast, not caring if I crash, almost hoping I do. But if I don't, it'll be okay. Because I'm going to the river. I'm going for a swim. I don't go to our usual spot. I go to where my brother died and stand on the edge of the cliff, looking down at the rushing river water. It's barely after 5. The sun's high above me, and I'm still in my perfectly normal clothes. In a way, I wish I'd worn something that meant more to me,
like one of James's old sweaters or Brady's t-shirts that we never got rid of. I lift up my hand and look again at the purple heart ring. It seems like a lifetime ago that he gave it to me, and I realize it was. It was Miller's lifetime ago. I start to cry. Bringing the ring to my lips, I kiss it, thinking of where James could be. We know nothing of the program, what it really does to people. On the news a few months back, they did an investigative report, but the story was overshadowed by the rising number of deaths. Any small violations they found, overuse of pills, patients being tied down, were pushed aside, and the focus was on the results. No one in the program died. They all went on to graduate, turn 18, disappear off the government radar. I lower my arm and watch the strong current below me. The drop is nearly 20 feet. The river is deep enough here that I won't smack the bottom, but I will get pulled under. I will be swept away, just like Brady was that day. And like him, I won't fight it. I'll let the darkness take me. Closing my eyes, I silently apologize to my parents, to everyone I've let down. And then, I fall forward. The wind rushes over my face, and the feeling of dropping flutters my stomach and makes me gasp in a breath just as I hit the water. Sharp coldness envelops me and fills my mouth, and I swing out my arms as I'm plunged deeper, pushed forward. It's dark and icy, and all at once, I'm terrified, lashing out for something to grab onto. I fight to breathe, but take in a mouthful of water instead, gagging as my body convulses. Oh God, I'm drowning. The pressure closes in on my chest, and I realize that I don't want to die. I don't want to die here. Just then, my body slams against a rock, hoisting me halfway out of the water. I hold on to it, vomiting up river until I'm sure I'll pass out and die anyway. My throat burns, my lungs ache, my arm is numb, and I think it may be broken. I'm focused on trying to breathe, even though my throat feels too tight. My adrenaline is keeping me conscious, but beyond that is a fear I've never known. Vulnerability I've never felt, and never want to feel again. I start to whimper. The river rushes by, my legs pulled downstream, but I hang on, listening to the sound of my shallow breaths. My eyes feel swollen and raw, and I blink as I see the world around me. The green of the leaves, the gray of the rock, the glistening of the setting sun on the water. I lay my head on my broken arm, my clothes stuck to me as I stare at my ring. I couldn't kill myself, couldn't let go like so many others had. I wonder if in their last moments they'd changed their minds, but there was no boulder to grab onto. I start to sob as I think about Brady and about how I should have gotten to him in the water sooner. Maybe he wanted to live. Maybe it's my fault that he didn't. I cling to the rock, crying until the thoughts fade and my body's spent. When I feel empty, I gather my strength and climb across the boulder, dragging myself to the shore. My legs are so numb from the cold that I can barely feel them touch the ground. My arm starts to throb at my side, and one of my shoes is lost in the river. It's dark when I finally make it back to the car. I'd left my key in the ignition, and when I turn it, I crank the heat to slowly thaw underneath the warm air. I stare through the windshield and think about how James will return from the program. They might not let me near him for a while, but they will eventually. And James isn't like other people. He's smart, resourceful. What if he doesn't get hollowed out? What if he comes back and remembers me? If it were me,
If I'd been sent to the program, I'd do everything I could to remember him. I'd find a way. I have to believe that James will too. I have to believe in him. My father is sitting on the porch stairs when I pull the car into the driveway. He jumps up immediately, rushing toward me. I shut off the engine and wait until he wrenches open the door. "Sloan," he calls, and then stops when he sees me. "What happened?" I slowly drag my eyes over to his. "I was trying to learn to swim," I say, and shrug. But when I do, a sharp pain tears through my arm. I wince and look down at it. "Are you hurt?" He leans in to touch me, but I shrink away. "Don't touch it," I say. "I think it's broken. The current was too strong and it..." "Helen," my father yells over his shoulder, calling to my mother. "Come on, sweetheart," he says to me, gently taking my uninjured elbow to help me out.
"Where were you?"
My mother's voice is frantic as she jogs from the house, her skin pale in the light of the front porch. Her hands search me, brushing back my wet hair, looking at the cuts on my cheek. "I was trying to swim," I say, and meet her tired eyes. "I know I've been horrible to you lately, and I thought maybe this could make up for it." My mother has always wanted me to learn how to swim, even though I was scared of the water. Once my brother was gone, I vowed never to learn. But I hope this lie makes her feel better. "I'm sorry," I add, lowering my head.
"Oh, Sloan," she says, hugging me, "you can't do things like this. I was so worried I almost called the police to look for you."
I stiffen.
"Did you?"
I'm suddenly terrified that she used the number on the pamphlet next to the phone, that my own mother would turn me in.
"No," she says. "Your father said you'd be back, that you were just venting."
She pronounces the word as if she can't remember what it means. I shoot a look at my father, but he keeps his eyes downcast. I wonder exactly how much he knows about where I've been.
"It was an accident," I say to my mother, trying to sound as peaceful as possible. "I thought it'd be great to learn, something to surprise James with when he comes back. But then I got pulled downstream. I'll be more careful next time."
"We should probably get you to the emergency room for that arm," my father cuts in. My mother gives him an alarmed look, as if he's stealing me from her.
"It's okay," I tell her. "I know how much you hate hospitals."
I smile then, trying to make her feel better. Or maybe I'm putting up the facade again.
"I'm healthy, Mom. See?"
The guilt from my outburst at dinner nags at me. The promise of James coming back strengthens me. I can make it through 6 weeks. James will be here, and we'll be together. We'll beat the program. My mother hugs me again, and I wince at the pressure on my aching arm.
"Sorry," she says. "I'm just so happy you're okay. I can't lose you too."
Her words strike my heart and remind me of Brady, how she cried for weeks after he died. How my father would drink too much, and then they'd scream at each other. I'd tried to comfort my mother until my own grief got the best of me. And then James became the only person I could trust to see that side of me.
"I'm okay, Mom," I say, sounding light, surprised how easily the lie comes out.
"You don't have to worry about me." She nods, clearly relieved, and I walk around the car as my father gets in the driver's seat. I raise my good arm and wave goodbye. Then I climb in and pull my seatbelt tight. My father starts the car and backs us out of the driveway, smiling at my mother reassuringly as we pass her. But once we're in the street, he looks sideways at me. "Sloan," he says, his voice low, "I know you weren't trying to swim.
But what I need to know right now is if you're going to do it. If I have to call the program to make sure your mother's last living child doesn't die.
Dad, don't lie to me, he says, not angry, just tired.
I just need the truth now. I don't think I can bear anything else.
I won't hurt myself, Dad. I couldn't.
He stares out at the road as we head toward the hospital. Thank you. And I watch my father, remembering how funny he used to be when Brady and I were kids, how he'd take my brother to R-rated films when he was in middle school, and me out for ice cream when I felt excluded. Now he looks older, wilted. The loss of my brother was too much for him, and sometimes I feel like he barely notices me at all anymore, except to make sure I'm still breathing. When we get to the emergency room, I tell them the trying-to-swim story, staying mostly believable. I have a small, clean break, and they tell me I'm lucky. Lucky. Once my cast is set, we leave the hospital to go back home, and my father is silent the entire way. I worry that he'll never speak to me again. Chapter 13. I wait. The days tick by, and I sit alone at lunch, watching the door, avoiding the gaze of the dark-haired handler. My arm is still in a cast, and I tell everyone it was an accident. They accept it with suspicious looks, but nothing more. After all, I'm smiling and looking pulled together. If I were sick, I couldn't do that. I'm fooling them. I spend more time with my parents, nodding numbly when they talk about the program or comment on the latest news story. Suicide has had a surge in London, and they've implemented their own version of the program. So far, it's been wildly successful, proving that America seems to have developed a treatment. It makes me wonder about the future. The sort of people who will be walking around in 20 years. People who never experienced their teens because those memories were erased. Will they be naive? Empty? I remind myself that James will be okay. He'll come back and be the same. I have to believe that. After school, I decide to go to the wellness center to gain credits, prove a point. Being seen there will show how healthy I am, how involved I am in my own stability. But really, I'll be waiting for James, knowing he'll show up sooner or later. The building is located within the middle of the city, a former YMCA. It's brick and old-looking, but the welcome sign is brightly colored, hinting at what's inside. The program is proud of their returners, of their system that is starting to see increases in voluntary admittance. The wellness center is the perfect front. Come see the results. Come see how shiny and new you can become. I stand out front, reluctant to go in. I'm afraid all these healthy people will see right through me, but I don't have anywhere else to go. I have to be strong.
You need to sign in, the woman behind the desk tells me as I pause in the entry.
Around her, the large open room is buzzing with activity, as if there's nothing outside these walls that could harm us. And the walls themselves are bright blue and green, loud and full of energy. I almost smile for real.
Miss? The lady asks, motioning toward the clipboard and the pen attached with yarn. Sign in for credit.
I sign my name and address on the paper and then scan the room. I recognize several faces, both returners and normal people. I don't know any of them that well, or at least I don't until I see Lacey. She's on the couch playing video games with Evan Freeman. There is a handler in the corner, but he's not the dark-haired one I'm afraid of. He's blonde, just standing there and watching Lacey silently. I think about going over there, introducing myself, but something holds me back.
In my head, I know that Lacey doesn't remember me, and yet, I hope that James will. So if I confirm that Lacey doesn't know me, what does that mean? I'm clinging to an unlikely expectation, but it's the only thing keeping me going. Every day, I feel myself slip more and more, but I'm holding on. I'm holding on for James. I wonder if Lacey even knows Miller is dead, if somewhere inside she misses him, misses all of us. Can the program take away our emotions, or do they always remain, only without a source? On the other side of the room, a group of girls, including Kendra Phillips, are giggling and drinking Diet Cokes while sitting at a round table. I make my way over, casting another glance at the handler who seems to have noticed me, before sitting down with the girls. They smile kindly, none of them remembering me as they keep talking, gossiping about boys, clothes, stuff that I can't even fathom caring about. But I've become a pretty good actress, so I laugh at the right moments, roll my eyes when it's needed. Inside, my heart hurts, but I cry only when I'm alone, on a long drive out in the country after leaving the center. No one is there to wipe my tears and tell me it'll be okay. For 3 weeks, I follow this pattern. Laugh, cry, laugh, cry. I've become numb, uncomfortably so, but it's the only way I can survive the time. When I finally get my cast off, I'm relieved as I stare down at my pale arm. James would have been so concerned if he'd seen me bandaged up the minute he got back. I hope he hurries. The days tick slowly by. I'm sitting at the table, painting my nails a horrid shade of pink as the girls talk about Evan Freeman, how he and Lacey are a thing. I don't react, pretending I don't know either of them. The door of the center opens, a soft jingle from the bells attached at the top. I'm concentrating on painting the nail of my ring finger, gazing at the purple heart there. I'm about to move on to the next nail when I realize that the room has gone quiet. Finally, they finally come for me. Exhausted, I glance up, sure it's a handler to take me to the program. But instead, the floor feels like it's dropped out from underneath me. There are handlers in their stiff white coats, but they're not alone. In between them, with a newly shaved head, is James. He's wearing a short-sleeved polo shirt, and I can see, even from here, the white marks on his arm. The tattoos have been removed, Miller's name stitched up. James's eyes scan the room, curious, but not intense, not the way he usually looks at things. They don't even pause on me. He's back. My James is back. This is the only reason I didn't die. This is the moment that kept me going. James. They walk him to a chair near the vending machines where a couple of guys sit, playing a game of cards. The handlers are letting James have his first bit of social interaction here at the wellness center, where it can be monitored. He sits, not saying a word to the people at the table. The handlers don't look at me, seemingly unaware of my and James's past. I wonder if that's true, or if they're trying not to draw his attention to me. Either way, I'm thankful that the dark-haired handler isn't here. I run my eyes over my boyfriend's clothes. He looks smaller, as if he's lost weight while he was gone. I don't like that they took away his beautiful golden hair, but it'll grow back. I ache to touch him. I watch his slow movements, my heart pounding, adrenaline racing through my veins. The girls around me start talking again, but it's quieter, as if they can sense my change. I wait for the right moment to approach James. I won't let anyone keep him from me. I have to get close.